Okay, so we can start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Today is November 7th, 2015. Okay, and so today we'll be taking sutta number 140 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, the discourse on the analysis of elements. Okay, so this sutta begins. First I'll do the introductory portion of the sutta, then I'll explain some of the background to the sutta. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha is wandering in the Magadhan country. Magadha is the state, now corresponds to modern Bihar in India. And then he eventually arrived at Rajagaha. That city still exists under the name Rajgir. And then he went to a potter whose name is Bhagava. Apparently this was a clan name of the potters, and said to him that he would like to stay just one night in the workshop, the potter's workshop. Then the potter says to him that it wouldn't be any inconvenience for him, but there is a homeless one, a pabajita, one who is renounced, you know, an ascetic, a wandering ascetic, who's already staying there. And so first you have to find out if it will be agreeable for him. Okay, so now the discourse tells us, or the sutta tells us, that there was a clansman named Pukusati who had gone forth from the home life into homeless life. I'm sorry, from the home life into homelessness out of faith in the Blessed One. And on that occasion, he was already staying in the potter's workshop. And so the pabajita, the homeless one who's staying in the workshop, is in fact somebody who has gone forth under or out of faith in the Buddha. And this person who's gone forth, his name is given as Pukusati. And no further identifying information about him is given in the sutta, but the commentary provides some background information. And as I often have to say, when it comes to commentaries, sometimes you have to remember that these are traditions which have been passed down orally, and we don't know to what extent they're reliable. But I believe that there's some confirmation of the Pali commentarial tradition in parallel to this sutta, which has come down in other traditions, in other schools. Okay, according to the commentary, Pukusati had been the king of, in Pali, the city is called Takasila, but it's better known under the Sanskrit name Takshila. And that was the capital city of the state of Gandhara, Gandhara now corresponds to, probably this would have been the eastern part of Gandhara, which now corresponds to Pakistan. Later, Gandhara came to comprise quite a large area, also including parts of what is now Afghanistan. In fact, if you follow the news, you sometimes read about very bitter fights taking place in Kandahar. Probably Kandahar is a corrupted pronunciation of Gandhar, Gandhara. Okay, so coming back to the commentarial story. So it says that Pukusati had been the king reigning at Takasila, and through merchants who would travel back and forth between Takasila and Rajagaha, Pukusati had struck up a kind of friendship by message, through messengers, with the king of the state of Magadha, who is Bimbisara. And so, as a token of their invisible friendship, invisible in that they had never met in person, Pukusati had sent Bimbisara in caskets. He had put these very expensive, very beautiful blankets. I guess Takasila was famous for the black, for the wool, quality of the wool. And so there were these beautiful blankets that he had prepared and sent them off to Bimbisara. Then Bimbisara wanted to know, or was pondering, what can I send my friend by correspondence, the King Pukusati, as a gift? And so King Bimbisara thought, it's no use sending him any kind of worldly goods, which just eventually decay. But let me share with him the Dharma of the Buddha. And so he had some, I think they were like gold foil sheets, so golden sheets prepared, and on them he inscribed passages from the Dhamma, passages in homage, the passages that describe the qualities of the three jewels, then other passages from various suttas, and sent them rolled up that piece of golden sheet, and then sent it with a lot of pomp and circumstance on the backs of elephants to Pukusati. Then when Pukusati received this gift from King Bimbisara, he opened up the caskets and took out the sheets and read them, and his mind was immediately uplifted with delight and bliss and ecstasy. And I think he started to practice Anapanasati and achieved, very quickly went into the four jhanas. And then he decided that continuing to reign over a kingdom is not in my long-term interest. And so I think one night when everybody in the palace was asleep, he slipped out of the palace and took some cloths and, you know, stitched them together and then dyed them the kind of saffron or ochre color, and then gave up his royal garments and put on the ochre robes, and then went forth as a wandering ascetic. Even though he hadn't taken formal ordination, but he declared that he was now an ascetic, sort of, who had gone forth under the Buddha. But he wanted to come to meet the Buddha in person and to be formally admitted into the Bhikkhu Sangha. And so he was under the impression, somehow he must have heard that the Buddha had his main seat, his main residence at Savatthi. Wait, let me just... No. He thought that the Buddha was living in Rajagaha. And so he headed for Rajagaha. But the Buddha was actually residing at the time in Savatthi. And along the way, I guess the road going from Takasila to Rajagaha would have passed through Savatthi. So he had actually passed through Savatthi, where the Buddha was living, but not aware that he was residing there. He continued on the journey, going further southeast to Rajagaha, until he arrived at Rajagaha and learned that the Buddha wasn't living here, that the Buddha was in Savatthi. And so he was going to spend a night at the potter's shed in order to, you know, well, to pass the night and recuperate from the journey, and then head back up north to Savatthi. But the Buddha, using his supervision, his supernormal vision, was aware of what was going on. And so the Buddha decided to go to Rajagaha in order to meet this young renunciant, Pukkusati. And so we see that the Buddha here, he's not traveling together with the community of monks. He doesn't have any attendant, but he's traveled alone. He set out by himself. Okay, so this is the background to the sutta. And so this is the background, I should say, according to the commentary. When I had read this sutta, you know, before I become acquainted with the commentarial background story, I always imagined it to myself as just a very ordinary young man, you know, without any distinguished background, who's become a kind of self-declared ascetic under the Buddha. And so I actually prefer it that way, rather than to glorify the figure by making him a renunciant king. Okay, so Pukkusati is already staying in the potter's workshop. And so the Buddha goes up to him and says, you know, the Buddha's apparently taking on a very humble role, just coming on like another traveling monk, saying, if it's not inconvenient for you, Bhikkhu, I will stay one night in the workshop. And it's interesting that here the Buddha addresses this young ascetic as bhikkhu, because usually we think now that bhikkhu is a distinctive term for a Buddhist monk. But the word bhikkhu actually comes from the noun bhikkha, bhikkha, or in Sanskrit bhiksha, which means food collected on alms round. And so bhikkhu is one who lives by collecting food on alms round. And so in the Buddha's time, this would have probably been a general term for the wandering ascetics who lived on alms round. Maybe somebody there wants to, is late for the class. Okay, so the Buddha asked permission from this young ascetic to spend a night in the workshop. And then, this is significant, the Pukkusati addresses the Buddha and he says, the potter's workshop is large enough. Here the word is translated friend, but the Pali word is avuso. And then we have let the venerable one, and here the word used in the text is ayasma, stay as long as he likes. Now this word avuso, translated friend is not really a very accurate translation. Yeah, the word abuso was a term of address that was used amongst monks and ascetics, which imply some degree of parity, that is, equality. You know, so when monks of roughly the same age level, in terms of ordination, speak to one another, they address each other as abuso. And in fact, later on, after when the Buddha was passing away, the instructions he gave for the continuation of the Sangha was that elder monks should address junior monks as abuso, whereas junior monks should address elder monks as bante. Okay, so when this Pukkusati addresses the Buddha as abuso, then it's suggesting that, you know, that they're just like fellow monks of the same, roughly of the same level. It doesn't imply any kind of spiritual superiority of one to the other, but it's just a friendly greeting. And then also the word ayasma, which is translated here as venerable one, again is the kind of address that one monk might use when speaking of another in the third person. Again, implying roughly some degree of, you know, similarity of status between the two. And this word, this address here, as we'll see probably next week, plays a significant role later in the sutta. Okay, so now the Buddha enters the workshop and he prepares. There must have been some mats in the workshop, or maybe the Buddha, when he's traveled, maybe he had a kind of straw mat that he carried with him in case he needs it. So he spreads this, well, maybe there was just grass piled up, maybe not a mat, but maybe just grass on the floor of the workshop. And so he prepares a spread of grass at one end, he sits down, crosses his legs, and then the text uses the stock expression, establishes mindfulness in front of him, which means that he enters into meditation. And so the Buddha spends most of the night seated in meditation, and the Venerable Pukkusati also spends most of the night seated in meditation. And then the Blessed One thinks that this young man is conducting himself in a very pleasing way or an inspiring way. You know, he's probably sitting in a very firm, solid posture. He's able to sit for a long time. So he says, suppose I were to question him. Okay, and now what the commentary explains, that is probably true, is that the Buddha already knew that Pukkusati had gone forth under him, but he has to start, he wants to start a conversation. And how do you start a conversation with another monk? The standard way was to say, like, under whom have you gone forth? Whose teaching do you follow? What kind of practice are you engaged in? Okay, so the Buddha asks Pukkusati these questions. And then now Pukkusati, he's, of course, whether he's been a king of Takshila or has just been a wandering ascetic, he's never seen the Buddha before. And what's interesting, this is a little bit of a puzzling, that, you know, the texts describe the Buddha as having something what they call the 32 marks of the great man, 80 minor characteristics, and sometimes when the Buddha wants to, he can emit the aura, fathom-wide aura. And even if we take these descriptions with some reservation, but I would think that the Buddha would have such a majestic appearance and emanate such a feeling of serenity and of wisdom that one would almost immediately, and charisma that one would almost immediately, if not identifying, this is the Buddha, think, wow, this is an extraordinary ascetic. And yet, Pukkasati doesn't see him as extraordinary in any way. And so what could be the reason for this?
Intention, yeah. So he won't know who he is, so he could actually teach him.
Yeah, I think that's the good point. That the Buddha has sort of, I would imagine that the Buddha has some control over his physical appearance. So when he wants all of his characteristics of the Mahapurusa, the characteristics of the great man, to become evident. For example, sometimes the Buddha wants to impress a Brahmin, so he'll let those characteristics become evident, and then the viewer, say the Brahmin, will see him and then will be struck by awe at the presence of the Buddha, and then will approach in order to learn from him. But here, if the Buddha comes on with his full, you know, majesty of his bearing, then Pukkasati will be awed. And they won't really have a chance for this conversation. And so the Buddha has subdued his physical appearance so that probably if one looks closely enough, one will see these distinctive characteristics, but they're not sort of shining forth in their full glory. Okay, so when the Buddha asks Pukkasati these questions, then Pukkasati explains, he says that there is the recluse, the samana named Gotama, who comes from the Sakyan clan and who has this particular reputation of being a blessed one, an accomplished one, fully enlightened and so forth. The teacher of gods and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one, I have gone forth under him. That blessed one is my teacher, and I profess the Dhamma of that blessed one. Okay, then the Buddha asks, but he says, where is the blessed one now living? You know, he's playing along as if he's not, you know, what? It's not lying, no. He's not speaking falsehood. He's just asking a question.
I'm just kidding.
But he's just playing along as if he is not the Blessed One. So he asks, where is that Blessed One now living? And Pukkasati says he's now living in Shravasti. Then the Buddha says, have you ever seen the Blessed One before? And would you recognize him if you saw him? And Pukkasati says, no. Okay, then the Buddha reflects that this clansman, the young man, has gone forth under me. Suppose I teach him the Dhamma. And this seems to me a little bit strange, because the Buddha then thinks, he says, Bhikkhu, I will teach you the Dhamma. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Like he hasn't established that he is also professing the Dhamma of the Blessed One. And you know, we don't know, like, how is Pukkasati to know, to understand at once that he's being taught the Dhamma of the Buddha? Suppose I come, I'm wandering on tour, and I come to a shed and somebody says, well, there is a clergyman now living in the shed, and the clergyman turns out to be maybe a Christian evangelical minister, and he says, I shall now teach you the gospel. I would feel a little bit like I'm being imposed upon.
But that may happen also with rich people. Sometimes they may be humble, they don't want people to know they're rich.
Yeah.
They want to be treated equal, otherwise yeah. Someone would just praise them and they just pay humble.
Yeah.
I've seen those cases before with people that are rich or famous.
Yeah.
Try to stay humble.
Yeah, but I would expect the Buddha to ask Pukkusati, well, what is it that Blessed One teaches? It's just to test him to see how much of the Dhamma he knows. Or else to say, I also know that. And I would expect Pukkusati then to ask the Buddha, under whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? What is the Dhamma that you profess? Yeah. But I guess one could suppose that probably what you could say what is original would be the teaching, and maybe the compilers had to construct, and maybe there was like an oral tradition of the background to the sutta. But what was part of the, what was the original sutta would have been the discourse itself. And so then the compilers had to construct a little bit of the dramatic framework around the sutta. And so we don't expect every logical step in the process of a conversation to take place. Okay, but now we come into the heart of the teaching here. And as in other suttas in this chapter on of vibhangas, of analyses, we begin with the udesa. The udesa is like the table of contents or the outline of the teaching. And then comes the vibhanga portion, the analysis or exposition of the outline. And so the outline goes like this, that this person, this individual, consists of six elements, six bases of contact, 18 kinds of mental exploration, and has four foundations. So those are the main themes that are going to be expounded. Then comes something which appears only towards the end of the sutta. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these four foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. The Pali expression is Muni Santo. That is, Muni is the sage, Santo is peaceful. Then one should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve truth. One should cultivate relinquishment. And one should train for peace. These four clauses are actually referring to what are called the four foundations, the four adhidhana. One of the senses of adhidhana is from the prefix adi, which means over, and tana is a place or even station. In fact, you could see the connection between the Pali and the English more easily through the Sanskrit. Tana would be stana, related to the English word stand or station. And so adhidhana is that over which one stands, that which one stands upon. And there are the four adhidhanas here, the four stations or foundations are wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. Okay, now the Buddha first goes through the first items in the summary, in the outline. And so these we've had, at least briefly, we've had them previously. Okay, so the person consists of six elements. What are the six elements? The earth element, water, fire, air element. Those are the four primary material elements. Then there's added another material element, the space element. And then, representing the mental side of experience, there is the consciousness element. And with the consciousness element, we can assume comes along the other three mental aggregates, though they're not expressly mentioned here. That is, we have feeling, perception, and all of the other mental activities. Okay, then we have the six bases for contact. Those are the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. These we've had several times already. Then we come to the 18 kinds of mental exploration, the 18 is a upavichara. Okay, so we can just go through them quickly. I explained these in greater detail when we took sutta number, I think, 137. Did we have the 18 upavicharas there? No, it was in sutta number 137. Okay, so on seeing a form with the eye, one explores with the mind, a form productive of joy, a form productive of grief, that's too strong, displeasure, dissatisfaction, unhappiness. One explores a form productive of equanimity. So we have forms that give rise to the three kinds of feelings, three kinds of mental feelings: joy, sadness, equanimity, through the eye, and similarly through the other five sense bases: ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So in that way we have three feelings through six sense bases, 18 mental explorations. Okay, then this person has four foundations. So these are the foundation of wisdom, the foundation of truth, the foundation of relinquishment, and the foundation of peace. And we can see that, or later we'll see that the four foundations are things that initially one has to cultivate and develop. And then when they become fully developed, then they become, we could say, the foundations on which the liberated one, the arahat, takes a stand. So the things that support the arahat, or the characteristics that are inalienable from the being of the liberated one. Okay, so these are the four foundations, and then that statement that one should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and should train for peace. This is just another way of formulating the four foundations. So this is the Buddha's injunction in cultivating these four qualities. And when those four qualities become fully developed, then they become foundations. And so here the Buddha picks up on, first on the statement that one should not neglect wisdom, and then he raises the question, how does one not neglect wisdom? And now he's going to explain the development of wisdom in terms of insight into the six elements. And so the Buddha is moving directly in his teaching to pukusati, moving directly into a teaching on the development of insight or panya, wisdom. He doesn't give pukusati the gradual step-by-step instruction, you know, starting from moral virtue through restraint of the senses, contentment, mindfulness and clear comprehension, overcoming the five hindrances, the four jhanas, because, at least according to the commentary, pukusati had already attained the four jhanas, so he already had mastered the preliminary stages of the practice. What he was lacking, because he hadn't met the Buddha directly in person, didn't have, or hadn't met even another monk who was skilled in the teaching, so he didn't have yet acquaintance with those teachings that conduce to the arising of wisdom. And so now the Buddha is going to give him that teaching by way of expounding on the six elements. And what's interesting in terms of the structure of this discourse, the Buddha begins by saying that the person consists of the six elements, but then when he elaborates on that statement, he merely enumerates the elements without elaboration. But it's when the Buddha picks up on the statement that one should not neglect wisdom that he then starts to elaborate on the elements. I don't know the reason for this rather sort of indirect way of treating the elements. Okay, so we come to the earth element. Again, we've had this basic formula. We've had several earlier suttas. So we have the earth element might be internal, that is pertaining to oneself, one's own body, or external. The earth element in the bodies of others, as well as in inanimate matter. So the internal earth element is whatever internally belongs to oneself is solid, hard, and clung to. So that is the distinctive feature of the earth element, is solidity or hardness. And according to the Buddhist philosophical explanation, all of the four elements, material elements, are present in any kind of material substance, but in certain substances, one element or the other predominates. And so we can use those particular material substances to illustrate that specific element. So with the earth element will be present even in, say, blood or sweat, but it's most prominent in the hard, solid parts of the body. And so to illustrate the earth element, the Buddha enumerates the parts, the solid parts: head hairs, body hairs, fingernail, toenails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, the intestines, mesentery, the contents of the stomach, feces, or anything else internally belonging to oneself that's solid, solidified, and clung to. Okay, so we have that's the internal earth element, and then the external earth element. You know, when we have, say, a plate of food in front of us, the food is, you could say, is external earth element. Rice, vegetables, tofu, whatever, fruit, it's all external earth element. Okay, but the internal earth, this is a way to depersonalize to break up the identification with the internal earth element, taking it to be I and mine, to contemplate that the internal earth element, the external earth element, are both simply the earth element. And so one way to do this with food is to, this is the way I've done it, is to contemplate that we have the plate of food, now it's external. Then I eat it, it goes into the stomach, it gets digested, and the parts that get metabolized, the substances that get metabolized, you know, today it's rice and vegetables and fruit, tomorrow it's pante. You know, it's right there in the photograph, or right there in your field of vision. And then the other side. That there's internal earth element, which certain point tomorrow in that room for which you close the door, then becomes earth external earth element. Okay, so when you see that the internal earth element and the external earth element of simply earth element, then one can contemplate this internal earth element, well actually one can contemplate both together as being not mine, not I, not myself. Contemplating it, yata bhutang samapanyaya, that is, as it actually is, with correct wisdom. So this is how one is developing wisdom, through insight into the selfless nature of the elements. And so when one sees it as it actually is with proper wisdom, then one becomes disenchanted. That is, one breaks up the illusion that connects to the earth element, I and mine. And then the mind becomes dispassionate towards the earth element. Okay, then similarly with the water element, its distinctive characteristic is that it is, well, it's given here that it's water, watery, and klamtu. But we could say that whatever is fluid, liquid in nature, that is the distinctive characteristic of the water element. And so that water element appears most distinctly in, here are the fluids of the body, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, the oil of the joints, urine, or whatever else pertaining to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. So this is the internal water element. And then one contemplates that this internal water element and the external water element are simply water element. So here I have the cup, legendary cup of herbal tea. So now, what is it? Yeah, what external water element? What is it now?
Pante.
Okay, then. There are times when the internal water element puts a little pressure on the bladder, and then sooner or later it becomes external water element. Okay, so then one contemplates it with proper wisdom as it, again, as it really is. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. One becomes disenchanted with the water element and dispassionate towards the water element. Then the fire element, the distinctive characteristic of the fire element is heat, warmth. Okay, and so whatever, so this needs a little explanation, whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery and clung to. That is that by which one is warmed. Okay, that's obvious. Ages. Now, according to the Indian physiology, it's the heat in the body that causes the body to age. So, you know, if you freeze something, like you freeze meat, it doesn't decay. If you take it out and keep it in the warmth, then in the heat, then it will decay. Similarly, with fruit, you put fruit in the refrigerator, it stays. You leave it out, it ripens, and then it gets overripe and decays. So that by which one is warmed, ages, and consumed, and that by which what is eaten and so forth gets completely digested. So this is the heat element, again according to the Indian physiology, is what is responsible for digestion. And similarly, one contemplates the external fire element, the internal fire element, the heat of the body, the external fire element, the heat of the sun, the warmth of the weather, as simply fire element and becomes detached from it. Okay, then the air element, here is simply described as whatever is air, airy and clung to, but the commentaries explain the air element because the air is manifest through the wind which blows, and so we see the air element most distinctly in motion, especially expansion and contraction, or in distension is expansion. Okay, so what is the internal air element? Again, some of this explanation depends on the ancient Indian physiology. So the upgoing winds, the downgoing winds, these would be what we would now call the nerve currents. Any doctor in the house? Biologist? There's the sensory nerve current and the motor nerve current. So the sensory would be the nerve current through which sensory data gets transmitted to the brain. And then the motor nerve current would be the nerve current by which thoughts originating in the mind get transformed into bodily activity. Okay, then there's winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, and then most distinctly we see the air element in respiration, in breathing and out breathing. And then internal air element, external air element are simply the air element. One becomes the other. I breathe in the air, and then the oxygen in the air becomes assimilated to my body, and the carbon dioxide that's rejected by the cells gets exhaled and becomes part of the atmosphere. And so in this way one contemplates all of this as being not mine, not I, not myself, and becomes detached from the air element. Okay, then we come to the space element, which in the Abhidhamma system is considered a type of secondary matter, derivative matter. And in the suttas, the Pali tradition, the space element is not considered what I call the all-comprehending space or the absolute space, but rather it is considered spaces that are not occupied by other material substances. So what is the internal space element? So whatever belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to. That is the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the opening of the mouth, and then that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed. I think that's called the esophagus, or the gullet. And then where it collects, that would be the space within the stomach. And then where it is, whereby it is excreted from below, that would be the open space of the intestines and the intestines, the anus. What is below the anus? Rectum, I'm sorry. Rectum. Okay, so the internal space, external space are simply the space element, again to be contemplated, not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, now we come to what is new in the sutta, and that is the consciousness element. And here the text speaks about the consciousness element as being purified and bright. And according to the commentary, I have a note here that the commentary explains it as the consciousness that accomplishes the work of insight contemplation on the elements. I'm not so sure that I agree with that. It seems to me, was this description purified and bright, parisuddham, pariyodhatam, would be a distinctive, it seems that this is describing the consciousness, I would say, of the fourth jhana. Of course, the consciousness element includes all consciousness, but that consciousness which becomes purified and bright would be the consciousness which has now been purified through the four jhanas, and maybe now it's being directed to the work of insight contemplation. Okay, so now the text goes on and says, what does one cognize, or what does one know with that consciousness? And often, when the Buddha is explaining the aggregate of consciousness, he'll explain it in terms of the six kinds of consciousness. That is, eye consciousness, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. Each of these consciousnesses knows its own distinctive object. So the eye knows forms, the ear knows sounds, the mind knows dhammas, mental objects. But here, the Buddha is explaining just in terms of feelings. I think the reason is that he is trying to direct, I would say, maybe because he's sketching okay, let me go backtrack. Maybe he's trying to build up again to the consciousness of the fourth jhana and then seeing what paths lie ahead for the practitioner when one has mastered the fourth jhana. Okay, so let's take a careful look at this passage. Okay, so what does one cognize? What does one know with that consciousness? So one knows, and the sutta just in the Pali just expresses it with what each object of knowledge with one word. So one knows pleasant, one knows pain, one knows neither pain nor pleasure. And so one is knowing feeling. And this seems to be here almost inserting into this passage one of the exercises in the Satipatthana system of meditation, that is the contemplation of feeling. Because when contemplation of feeling, how does the contemplation of feeling develop? If we just look at Sutta number 10, contemplation of feeling is on page 149. So when feeling a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, one understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant, one understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So here we have almost spliced in a brief reference to the contemplation of feeling. Then, when one feels a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. And then the understanding goes on with the cessation of, independence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, there arises a pleasant feeling. When one feels a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. One understands with the cessation of that contact to be felt as pleasant, its corresponding feeling, that is, the pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on that contact, that feeling ceases and subsides. So in that very brief statement, what can we see sort of entailed? What other teachings entailed here? I see two of them.
Impermanence?
Yeah, impermanence is one. There's another. Exactly. Very good. So we got both of them, each with one shot. So we have dependent arising, because in dependence on contact, there arises feeling. And then, with the cessation of that contact, then the feeling that arises based on it ceases. So there we have both the cessation aspect of dependent origination and, because it's cessation, impermanence. This is a very nice jasmine tea.
It's oolong.
Oolong, but it has a jasmine-like flavor.
I add just one pearl.
Of jasmine?
Yeah.
You see, when there's a pleasant contact, pleasant feeling arises. With the cessation of contact, that pleasant feeling ceases. Okay, in dependence on a contact to be felt as painful, there arises a painful feeling. Okay, this is just applies the same thing to the painful feeling and then to the neither painful nor pleasant feeling. We don't have to repeat the full passage. Okay, now the Buddha illustrates this. After the section on neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he says, just as from the contact and friction of two fire sticks, heat is generated and fire is produced, and with the separation of those two fire sticks, the heat ceases and subsides, so in dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, painful, neutral, there arises respectively a pleasant, painful, neutral feeling. And so what makes the contact here, the way I see it, it's not the sense, it's not just the sense faculty and the sense object, but in the contact there's actually three factors involved. In the fire sticks there's only two. Maybe actually you could say the three and the fire sticks, maybe. Anybody have experience with fire sticks? We're too modern. Okay, you have the lower fire stick, the upper fire stick, then you rub them together. And that produces the heat. So in the case of contact, you have sense object, sense organ or sense faculty, and then the mind has to make contact with the object through the sense faculty, through the sense faculty. So when those three come together, that is contact, and from that contact there arises the feeling. Okay, so one understands with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, its corresponding feeling ceases and subsides. Okay, now the text says, then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Okay, here the commentary identifies this. This is what I would think. The identifies this equanimity with the equanimity of the fourth jhana, which Pukkhasati had already attained, according to the commentary. And now the Buddha describes this equanimity as purified and bright, parisuddhang, pariyodhatang, it's malleable. I think this would be mudung, wieldy, kamanyang, and radiant, babasara. So this would be the mind, the equanimity present in the mind of the fourth jhana. And again the Buddha, in order to praise this equanimity, he uses a simile, the simile of gold. So we have a skilled goldsmith is preparing a furnace, heats it up, he takes some gold and that he wants to refine, he puts it into the crucible. Then from time to time he blows on it, from time to time sprinkles water over it, from time to time just looks on, and in this way that gold becomes refined, well refined, completely refined, faultless, rid of the impurities, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. There's a kind of intersection here with another sutta that occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Threes, different numbering systems. I think I have it as Sutta number 99 in the Book of Threes, but the Pali Text Society had slightly different numbering. I think it came out to be, maybe in my Anguttara, maybe it was 100, but it uses the simile of a goldsmith refining gold to illustrate how a meditator refines the mind. And blowing on the gold with fan is like applying energy when it's time to apply energy. Sprinkling water over the gold is like when it's time to relax the exertion and then to focus the mind or let the mind just settle down and become quiet, more quiet. Because the sprinkling water over the gold tempers the heat, and so turning the mind towards samadhi helps to settle down any kind of agitation or restlessness brought on by that effort. And then when everything is in balance and the process of cultivation is going smoothly, then one just looks on with equanimity. So that is like the goldsmith looks on at the gold as the refining process is taking place. Okay, then whatever kind of ornament that goldsmith might want to make from that gold, the chain, earrings, necklace, and so forth, he'll be able to do so. The sutta that I referred to from the Anguttara Nikaya then explains how when the mind has been cultivated through the balance of these three qualities, energy, stillness, or concentration, and equanimity, then one can develop the six superpowers, that is the five mundane superpowers, like psychic powers, or the ability to read the minds of others, the divine ear, the recollection of past lives, and the knowledge, that's the ability to see the passing away and rebirth of others. And then the sixth is the super, the world-transcending superpower, that is the power of liberation. Okay, so now the Buddha continues. He says, okay, after the simile, he says, then there remains only this equanimity, or a mind of equanimity, which has been purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Okay, then the meditator understands, if I were to direct this equanimity, remember this is the equanimity now in the fourth jhana, so the question here is, what lies beyond the fourth jhana? What are the possibilities? So one possibility is to continue the process of mental refinement, moving in from the fourth jhana, moving upwards to the arupa attainments, the formless meditative absorptions. So the meditator thinks, if I were to direct this equanimity, purified and bright, to the base of the of infinite space, that is the first, the lowest of the four formless meditations, and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mine, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. Let me just read the whole passage and I'll come back and explain. If I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite consciousness, this is the second formless meditative absorption, and to develop my mind accordingly, again, this equanimity of mine would remain for a very long time. If I were to direct this equanimity to the base of nothingness, the third formless meditative absorption, and then to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, the fourth formless meditative absorption, and to develop my mind accordingly, this equanimity of mind, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. Okay, the implication of this first is that to direct that equanimity, okay, start at the bottom to the base of infinite space and develop the mind accordingly means that one directs the mind to the base of infinite space and then one develops the concentration to the point where one can attain that absorption in the base of infinite space. And then by attaining that absorption without going further, then that mind at death will move on to re-arising or rebirth in the sphere of existence called the sphere of the infinity of space, which is the lowest of the four formless spheres of existence. And dwelling there, it might abide or remain for a very long time, because it's said that the lifespan of the beings in that realm is said to be like 20,000 great kalpas, great kalpas, great aeons. So it's inconceivable long time. And similarly, if one develops the base of infinite consciousness, even longer. If one develops the base of nothingness, the lifespan and the sphere of the plane of nothingness, even longer. If one develops the base of neither perception nor non-perception, without going further, then when rebirth occurs, the mind re-arises in the sphere or plane of neither perception nor non-perception and remains there for some 80,000, 84,000 great aeons, mahakalpas. But notice the expression that describes each of these bases, that is said that the Pali uses the expression tung nisita tung tad upadana. So nisita is dependent upon. So the mind is dependent upon that attainment. And tad upadana, upadana is clinging, but it also suggests the idea of a sustenance is a good rendering. What sustains it? So it's the mind is sustained by that equanimity and dependent upon it. But because it's dependent and because that equanimity is founded upon clinging, it's impermanent. It's, you could say, it's defective, it's flawed. And so we have the next paragraph is sort of in a way the key to this whole section of the sutta. So it says that he understands thus, if I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite space and to develop my mind accordingly, this would be conditioned. And then similarly, if I were to develop this, to direct this equanimity to the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, this would be conditioned. And then the commentary has a very nice explanation. That word conditioned, in a sense, reveals the whole unsatisfactory nature of these attainments. That because they're conditioned, they are fueled and supported by conditions. And because those conditions are impermanent, it means that these states of attainment and these existence in these planes of rebirth are also impermanent. So the commentary says, yeah, this is the note number 1277, it says, this is said in order to show the danger or defect in the immaterial or the formless meditations. By the one phrase, this would be conditioned, he shows, even though the lifespan there, that is in the sphere of infinite space, is 20,000 aeons, that is conditioned, fashioned or fabricated, built up. It is thus impermanent, unstable, not lasting, transient. It is subject to perishing, breaking up, and dissolution. It is involved with birth, aging, and death, grounded upon suffering. It is not a shelter, a place of safety, a refuge. And so, having passed away from there as a worldling, one can still be reborn in any of the four states, the bad destinations. And so, if one were just to develop those formless absorptions without developing insight wisdom, then one could take rebirth there in those super planes, super elevated planes, and live for 20,000, 40,000, 80,000 aeons. But eventually, the alarm clock goes off. And when the alarm clock rings, then the mind passes away from there and takes rebirth elsewhere. And the cycle of birth and death goes on. And so this is why when the Buddha, before his enlightenment, when he was a seeker of enlightenment, under the first two teachers, he learned how to attain the base of nothingness and how to attain the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But he wasn't satisfied with those because he knew these states are not final, not ultimate. They're conditioned, impermanent. And if I take rebirth through them, that comes to an end and I'm not liberated. Okay, so then the text continues. He does not, so when he understands this, then he does not form. Here, the Pali is so well expressed and so difficult to render to English, so it's very awkward, this attempt to translate. The Pali says, neva tan abhisankaroti na abhisanchetayati bhavayava vibhavayava. So we have the verb abhisankaroti, which suggests putting together, constructing, formulating. So here we have to render not form any condition. Then abhisanchetayati, it's an act involving volition. So here we have to render generate any volition. So he does not form any condition or generate any volition for either being, that's continued existence, that is desiring to exist in any of these higher realms of existence, or for non-being, any desire for personal annihilation. But since he doesn't form any condition or generate any volition towards either being or non-being, for either eternal existence or for personal annihilation, he does not cling to anything in the world. And here the verb na upadeyati does not cling, sort of resonates with the fault in these four attainments, that they are based, that they're supported by that base clinging to it. So this is sort of the negation of that. So he does not cling to anything in the world. Then when he does not cling, again, there's always these linguistic problems. na paritasate. Here it's rendered, he is not agitated. But this is a verb, na paritasate. Which brings over resonances, or it merges two verbs which would be quite distinct in Sanskrit, but come together in Pali. One verb suggests craving. This would be in Sanskrit paritrishyate. And the other suggests fear. This would be tasati, paritasati. But in Pali, the two verbs come together, so we have one verb, paritasati, suggesting with two nuances, one suggesting that he doesn't have any more craving, the other doesn't have any more fear. How does one render that in English?
Peaceful. Peaceful.
We have to say he doesn't. Well, the one word, because these two Sanskrit verbs have sort of become conflated in Pali, suggests two nuances. He does not have craving, does not have fear. So we have to find one word that will render both ideas.
Apprehension?
What?
Apprehension.
Apprehension. That tends more towards fear. No, we want to get the negation, does not, or is not.
Neutral, feckless. Feckless.
I'm not getting it.
Feckless.
Deathless.
Deathless.
Feckless.
Feckless. He is not. That would sound a little strange. Feckless. Anyway, I went for it. He is not agitated. Which, I mean, it's not satisfactory, but it's very hard to come up with a solution. Okay, so when he is not agitated, then we have next a verb, parinibbhayati, which we have to render with a substantive English word, you see. So he attains nibbana as though it's some kind of substantial thing that he attains. But in Pali, it's just indicated with the verb. So parinibbhayati, he is, if you want to translate very literally, you say he is nibbanized, nirvanized. You see, it's not so easy to translate these passages.
It takes a lifetime.
No, even, it's not a matter of how long it takes, but it's just that we don't have, you know, either satisfactory words, or say Pali can suggest with verbs things that we have to render with a verb and a noun. Okay, then he understands birth is destroyed, or let's say birth is finished, that's better, that the cycle of births, rebirths is finished, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. Even that's problematic. Na parangita tayati. That no more, literally, is no more for thisness. Okay, I didn't leave time for questions, but we'll come back, we'll break for the lunch, and then we can come back and have some questions and discussion. You see, it's a very rich sutta. And then the last part is very beautiful, so we'll have to take it next week. Okay, so, yeah, we do the sharing of the merits. it's been so long since I've done a class that I'm forgetting, what do I do? Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantana Bodhiva Chiram Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantana Bodhiva Chiram Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyanta Nanamodipa Shiram Rakantu Mamparam Eta Patacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Deva Namodantu Sava Sampati Siddhya Eta Patacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Buddha Namodantu Sava Sampati Siddhya Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagopadaya avichihetato etantare satakayo papana rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu vibhutin. Okay, do three half hours for the good.
Out of bounds.